You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear about a Madison native who's the only American writer to win Pulitzer Prizes for both fiction and drama.
First, according to a 2015 Gallup poll, confidence in police in America is the lowest it's been in more than 20 years, and that's creating an uncertain landscape for some of Wisconsin's newest police officers.
WPR Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden is following a class of recruits in the Madison Police Department to see how they're trained, what they learn, and how they feel about sometimes difficult police-community relations.
And she joins us now in studio. Bridget, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Bridget, how did you end up embedding with this new class of police officers?
So it goes back probably a few months ago, during the week that Alton Sterling and Philando Castile were shot. I was doing some thinking, and you know, I really wanted to sort of get a handle on policing right now and policing issues. And so I was thinking about training, and I realized that I didn't really know a lot about how police are trained. So I approached the Madison Police Department and asked if I could follow their next class of recruits. And they said yes, so I will be embedding with this class of recruits from now till February when they graduate.
So that's a big journey you're undertaking. Are you going to be doing pretty much everything that these new would-be officers are doing each step of the way?
I'll be spending several hours with them each week. I can't say that I'll be there for every lesson. You know, there are a lot of lectures, a lot of memorization of codes. But all the big days, I'll be there. I will even be able to participate in some of the lessons. So, for example, at the end of this week, I'll be participating in the ropes course that the recruits go through.
Interesting. So you had your very first day today. What was it like?
Right. So today was the first day of the academy. There are 23 recruits in this class. It's the 59th class of the Madison Police Training Academy. They came in first thing this morning, and you know, they got together in their classroom. They were given school supplies. They heard from the training officers. And then they went into a sort of a lecture hall where they were joined by their families and other police officers, figures from the city, and they were sworn in. They took an oath.
And what was that swearing-in ceremony like?
So there were several people from the city, including Chief Koval, but also Mayor Paul Soglin was there, and he gave a speech.
There's a lot to be done out on the streets at 2 o'clock in the morning. But going to a neighborhood meeting where you're going to be held accountable for every decision made by every police officer is a challenge that our captains, our lieutenants, our chiefs cannot give you adequate experience.
So yeah, the mayor spoke to the class, and he really stressed the importance of neighborhoods and the importance of officers being with the community face to face and doing policing that way.
And when you take a role on a stage in front of a neighborhood and you portray yourself as the sole authority, you may be doing a disservice to the neighborhood as well as to our city. So keep in mind, while you're out there, you are leaders, you are there to protect, but you're also there to build strong neighborhoods.
You really get a sense there of the gravity of the office of police officer. Did you feel that when you were in that room, that this was not something that anyone was entering into lightly, and that there was, especially at this time in police history, a lot riding on this job?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of the recruits today were excited, but also anxious. They knew that this was a big day and that they're entering into something that is a very serious task to take on. Chief Koval also addressed the fact that this is a difficult time to be entering policing. There's a lot of tension, obviously, in this community and communities across the country about police. So he spoke about that briefly.
We're talking with WPR reporter Bridget Bowden right now, and you can follow her reporting on a new class of police recruits at WPR.org. We're going to hear more about that. This is an ongoing series. Today was her very first day embedding with this new class. And tell us more about what Chief Koval had to say today.
Yeah, he actually started out by obviously addressing the recruits and telling the crowd of their families and other law enforcement officers about them. He specifically wanted to stress to the crowd that this class is coming from a variety of previous professions. So there are obviously some people who have been law enforcement officers at other agencies or people that are just coming off of a criminal justice degree in college. But then there are several people whose background is in fine arts or social work or therapy. And he wanted to praise them for that.
And we hear a lot of concerns about bias today and the difficult relations between police and communities of color. How are those, you know, looking ahead at how this will be handled with this class of police officers?
Yeah, last week I spoke with Captain Tom Snyder, who oversees hiring and training for the department. And he said that the concerns that you just talked about, bias, racism, that we're seeing, actually, he thinks they had an effect on recruitment this last year. Recruitment was down about 22%. They received 22% fewer applications. So it has had a real tangible effect. I should note, though, that he said that at this point, applications are back up for next year.
And you said you talked to the recruits, and there was a sense almost of anxiousness, because this is day one, that makes a lot of sense. But what did people say about why they were anxious and how they were feeling?
Yeah, so I actually didn't get as much time as I would have liked to speak to the recruits one-on-one today, mostly because their families were there. But what I heard from the crowd was that, you know, it was a really big day. A lot of the people have actually moved to Madison to take this job. Some of them have moved families. So yeah, it's huge. It's a big commitment that the academy takes almost 6 months.
Did you get a sense of what the diversity was like in that class of police officers? Were you seeing, for instance, sizable populations there of women and of people of color within this class?
Yeah, I wish I had brought my exact breakdown, but I do know off the top of my head that the class is 44% women, and that's out of 23 people. I believe it is 17% African American. So there is diversity there. Another thing that's interesting is that there's quite a bit of age diversity. I believe the youngest person is either 21 or 22, and the oldest person is 39.
So, Bridget, looking ahead, you said you'll be doing the ropes course with this class on Friday. What else? What are some of the other big milestones that we can look forward to in your reporting coming up?
Yeah, I definitely want to learn about the hot topics of policing, you know, mental health, deadly force. So you can definitely expect stories on how these recruits are learning about those topics. But I'm also interested in, you know, smaller topics. So what it's like to become an officer in 2016, what these people's families go through. I'm just interested in learning about the whole process.
Well, we look forward to hearing more. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Bridget Bowden, and you can follow her reporting on that new class of police recruits. You can find that at WPR.org. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
The Pulitzer Prizes turn 100 this year. We're honoring the occasion with a look at five winners with Wisconsin ties. Few people win even one Pulitzer Prize. Madison-born Thornton Wilder won three, including one for his seminal play, Our Town. Wilder's nephew, Tappan Wilder, tells us about his uncle.
I was in Chicago recently, and I ran into an old friend I hadn't seen in almost 50 years, and he reminded me of Thornton Wilder coming to read a play when I was an undergraduate in college. And my uncle, when he was in town, we'd run around quite a lot, and I brought him down to read one of his plays to some of my friends, and he remembers my uncle describing himself as a cricket. He never quite came down in the same place. And that's really a marvelous memory of a man who, in a way, lived in his head, traveled abroad a great deal. This is a man who spoke several languages. There was hardly a waiter he couldn't talk to in his own language. And was a novelist, playwright, a translator of plays, an extraordinary letter writer, probably 12 or 13,000 letters. What wrote essays, had these enormous research interests, was an actor, fought in two wars, lived in many places, and I guess I think of him as being somewhere and sort of everywhere. It's well known, though, that Thornton Wilder's father just wrung his hands at Thornton Wilder because he was, his head was in the sky and he was always scribbling. And how's this kid going to make a living? The open road represented something to him. That was part of the way he lived. And meeting people along the way was very important because he loved to hang out and listen to people talking. He was the eyes on the wall. You know, he was the guy at the bar, just listening and picking up stuff, which becomes part of his art. The Bridge of San Luis Rey, in telling that story in a way of really enormous beauty and with great style, he's terribly interested in the range of human experience and the beauty of the human experience, its preciousness, and it is very precious, and an awful lot of people die in Thornton Wilder's work, and he uses death in order to explore the nature of life. It was made into a movie. It's been made 3 times into a movie, actually. And the bridge has never stopped falling.
I saw the Marquesa's coach quickly follow that of the Viceroy's. I learned later that she had come to visit your little chapel of San Luis Rey to meditate and pray at the famous shrine.
He was a, you know, Thornton Wilder was a really nice guy. I mean, some people say one reason why he's a little unknown is he didn't have all the edges that Hemingway and Fitzgerald, his very good friends, I might add. You know, they had a lot of hard, pretty interesting edges which attracted a lot of press. But he wasn't like those fellas, and therefore some people say it's some one reason why he's not quite as well known as he should be. But he was very interested in everybody, including his nephew. You know, what am I studying? What was I thinking? And he was always eager to read my term papers. I passed on that opportunity. I was a little shy about showing him my academic work, to tell you the truth.
Tappan Wilder is the nephew and literary executor for the Thornton Wilder Estate. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Joining us now to tell us more about the life and work of Thornton Wilder is Mary English, professor of classics at Montclair State University and executive director of the Thornton Wilder Society. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
No, thank you.
Well, can you tell us a little bit more about Thornton Wilder's upbringing here in Wisconsin? I gather he didn't spend a whole ton of his life here in the state.
No, he didn't, but I think his Wisconsin roots were very important to him. He was born in 1897 in Madison, Wisconsin. His mother and father had come to Madison a few years earlier because his father was a journalist. He had gotten he got a part ownership and was the editor of the Wisconsin State Journal. So the family established themselves in Madison, and they lived there until 1906 when Thornton Wilder's father got appointed by Teddy Roosevelt to be the consul general to Hong Kong. And so the family then starts to live abroad and eventually relocates to California. But the Wilder family had... was associated with several addresses in Madison, and they also had a summer cottage in Maple Bluff.
And were there signs pretty early on that this was going to be a literary person, even as a child? Was he writing from an early age?
He was writing from an early age. I mean, clearly he was born into a family concerned with literature and writing. Like I said, his father was a journalist there in Madison, and Thornton Wilder's mother maintained a lifelong interest in poetry, drama, opera, literature. And in preparing for the interview today, I was looking at some photos. There's a great picture of the children. There were 4 Wilder children when they were living in Wisconsin. There's one comes along later, and they're in a huge baby pram, And legend has it that, or family legend has it that Thornton Wilder's mother would often be seen around Madison pushing this large pram and holding a book in one hand. So I think that it's sort of into that type of family that Thornton Wilder was born, but that also then from a very young age he took to literature and he took to drama, and certainly I think that a lifelong passion resulted in those great Pulitzer Prize winning plays.
You mentioned the family ended up in Hong Kong. That started a lot of travel around the world. Is that something that informed Thornton Wilder, the writer, the playwright?
I think yes. I think they went abroad and then they stayed in Asia for a while, and then the mother returns with the children and they settle in Berkeley, so another highly literate city, and then they go back to Asia later around like 1911 or 1912, and Wilder spends some of his high school years in China, and then finishes high school again in Berkeley in California, and I think that started like this sort of lifelong interest that he had in exploring the world and writing in various locations. And actually being sort of a student of people, like going out and there's many accounts of him enjoying meeting people on trains and in restaurants and sort of I think that sort of vision of the world reveals itself in the plays and gives them sort of a universality that sort of resonates with lots of audience members.
We heard in the piece how he was a really nice guy, that he didn't have a lot of rough edges, and that may have led, people not to cover him maybe as much as they would have someone else who was more likely to generate headlines. So where did Our Town come from? I mean, it's kind of a dark play. It's gentle, but it's also pretty obsessed with death. How do those two versions of him as this sort of mild guy go along with Our Town?
Well, I think Our Town is an interesting play that way. In form, it's both experimental, and certainly a radical play for American drama in the 1930s. Thornton Wilder wasn't afraid to break the fourth wall, have his stage manager in Our Town speak directly to the audience. It was one of the in a period where the plays are steeped in realism. And having the action unfold in a very sequential manner, Our Town covers the lifespan of some of its characters and has flashbacks and sort of plays with time that way. On the other hand, the play is also strikingly familiar to people, in its very essence and its subject matter, in its title, and it is a town and characters that people can see themselves in. And I think that sort of familiarity led to the success of the production, but then also sort of categorizes the play as sentimental, when really, like you said in the question, it's not a sentimental play in the third act at all. It's more painful and poignant moments can be played with an edge, and they don't really have to transfer over to sentimentality. And I think the best productions kind of capture that duality between something shocking and experimental and something familiar, where the audience can use their imagination and see themselves reflected in the setting and the characters and the plot.
Yeah, I saw my brother in this play in the high school production of it. It clearly became a standard. Did that happen right away, or is this something that was kind of rediscovered over time?
It definitely happened right away. It had once the play finished its Broadway run and was released to the amateur market, it was immediately picked up both by a community theater and small non-professional theater groups, as well as high school drama programs. And it's still one of the most widely produced plays in the high school market, for lots of reasons. I think not just because of the universal themes we were talking about a minute ago, but because of the very practical things. It has a huge cast. It has lots of good parts for young actors, and it requires no scenery and no stage props, and really forces the actors to embody the text that way. So it has lots of potential, I think, for an acting program and an acting teacher to sort of push the students and sort of bring out the best in them. And from what I've gathered, Thornton Wilder was always very glad that the play sort of resonated that way, and sort of both the playwright himself and his family have always encouraged those productions, and I think see it as a tribute to the success of the work that so many people in America either have seen Our Town at their school or been in a production of Our Town.
And just very briefly, as we wrap up, just a little bit of time here, did he get the recognition he was due at the end of his life?
I think he did in that way. I think Thornton Wilder is a household name that when you say Thornton Wilder, people know immediately. The aspect of him that I don't think has gotten that much recognition is his works outside of sort of Our Town and The Matchmaker, which is the play that eventually becomes Hello, Dolly. So I think people know him through those works, but he has a whole host of wonderful novels, not just The Bridge of San Luis Rey, which he wrote as a young writer, but a lot of his later novels are very interesting and intricate, and I don't think...
And we have to leave it there. Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
That was Mary English, professor of classics at Montclair State University and executive director of the Thornton Wilder Society. We've been talking about a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and playwright, Thornton Wilder. The question of candidate health is being highlighted in the presidential campaign after an incident involving Hillary Clinton over the weekend. The Democratic candidate was forced to leave a 9/11 memorial ceremony abruptly and had to be helped into her car after signs of illness. Her campaign initially said that she was overheated, but her physician later released a statement saying she'd been diagnosed with pneumonia on Friday.
Clinton's opponent, Donald Trump, responded to the incident, telling Fox News in an interview that health is definitely an issue in this election. Both candidates have released a limited amount of information about their medical history, though Trump says he took a medical exam last week and will release the results when the numbers come in. All of this raises broader questions about how the health of our candidates may influence our opinions and our votes, and how much we, the public, have the right to know about this usually private information.
Melissa Miller joins us now. She's an associate professor of political science at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how important is a candidate's health to voters, do you think, when it comes to deciding who they're going to vote for?
Of all of the factors that predict presidential vote choice in any given year, I'd say the health of the candidates is probably not at the top of the list. Despite all of the media attention this is getting, and it's definitely an important issue. But the big predictor of vote choice is, of course, the person's partisanship. The Clinton health scare, I don't think is going to, she's not going to lose her supporters. She's not going to lose the solid Democrats who would be in her camp and vote for her no matter what. But I think the fact that Trump was already trying to make an issue of her health suggests that in a close election, these kinds of things that have to do with candidate health or candidate character or one candidate makes a gaffe, if it's a close election, and this one may well be, certainly here in Ohio, these issues are what keep the candidates up at night, hopefully not making them ill. But, the campaign staffs worry about perception. And so, this is something that the Clinton campaign needs to address and address quickly.
And one of the critiques of the way the whole thing had been handled, and they've, of course, said this was not handled in the best possible way by us, but they have been accused of, you know, keeping something secret that maybe didn't have to be secret, which is a charge that she's been sort of plagued with this whole campaign, that there's too much secrecy.
That's right. So I think there are really two ways in which this development can harm the campaign. And one is what you just mentioned, that the perception, you know, beyond whether there's a real health scare here for her or not, is that they didn't handle it well. They kept the information to themselves, and they waited until basically they had to say something. So she got the diagnosis on Friday and kept her schedule, and it wasn't until she had to leave the 9/11 memorial event and the video of her slumping at the, you know, by the car and being held up went viral. And so now they had to address it. And what it does is feed that pre-existing narrative that the Clintons are secretive and the Clintons aren't forthcoming. And that's unfortunate. Now, I'll tell you that, you know, my guess is any candidate, you know, doesn't necessarily, like, leaving the campaign trail is not something any candidate wants to do unless it's for a really good reason. So I think, given what we know about her and her drive, you know, I suspect that they thought they could power through it. That didn't turn out to be the case, and now it feeds this pre-existing narrative that they withheld information. But I think the second problem politically that it causes is that Donald Trump was already trying to make Clinton's health an issue. And until today, it was kind of an effort that was on the fringes. He kept trying to bring it up, but for the most part, there was really nothing convincing to the allegations. In fact, many accused Trump of trying to manufacture the story. Well, now, you know, that it's come to this, and it's come to the video of having to leave the 9/11 event, again, what it does is it takes what was kind of a minor annoyance of Trump, right, trying to criticize her and question her health, is now a mainstream news story. So the Clinton campaign needs to figure out quickly how to deal with this.
We're talking with political scientist Melissa Miller about the issue of candidate health in the presidential race and how much it matters. Does it influence the vote? And what about keeping things, you know, under wraps for a little while as they resolve? Or does the public really have a right to know? And I want to get into that next, Melissa. I mean, does the public have a right to know? This is a candidate, whether it's Hillary Clinton in this case or Donald Trump, who some have been upset because his doctor's letter was not very thorough, talking about his health, or very scientific or doctorly in a way, to use a term. I mean, do we have a right to know? This is typically something that is confidential between a patient and their physician. How much do we get to be privy to?
I think, you know, you can make an argument both ways on that, right? Does the public have a right to know? You know, arguably, yes, given that we're choosing the president of the United States. You know, this person will be the leader of the free world. This person will have incredible power. This person will have access to the nuclear codes. And so I think that's why there has been a tradition that has developed over time in which the candidates running for president, particularly the major party nominees during the fall election campaign, do release their health information. And that's what has made this 2016 election kind of different, because Trump, as you point out, Veronica, released a very short, brief letter with no specifics from his doctor. Clinton released a two-page summary, so slightly more information, but neither candidate was nearly as forthcoming as the two candidates in 2008. At that time, Barack Obama's doctor offered a 276-page report about then-Senator Barack Obama, and John McCain, who had had several brushes with skin cancer, he released 1,200 pages of medical history. So following on that, it was already, I thought, sort of a problem for both campaigns that neither was being forthcoming. Now, the flip side of this that concerns me is that if we're demanding that our candidates must release their medical records, or at least detailed summaries of their medical history, at what point does it seem so invasive that fewer and fewer people are willing to run for president? Or they're just projecting, like if they're considering running for mayor or city council or state representative, and observing a campaign at the presidential level, which is highly visible and seems to, you know, not only be pretty negative, but also like delving into the private medical history, I worry that it could have a chilling effect on people's willingness to throw their hat in the ring. And if one, there's one thing we know from Americans at all ends of the political spectrum, we want more candidates. We want more good quality candidates. So I do worry about a possible chilling effect when it appears that to run for office, you really have to, you know, your life then becomes an open book.
Is this special circumstances, though? I mean, these are two candidates who are among the oldest ever candidates to run for president. Hillary Clinton is 68. Donald Trump is 70. So in that case, maybe there should be more scrutiny about how healthy they are.
You know, it's interesting because one of the instances that comes to mind for me historically when it wasn't health, but it was age that came up, and that was in 1984 when Democrat Walter Mondale tried to make an issue of Ronald Reagan's age and kind of implicitly implying, like, you know, do we want someone of this age, you know, to serve a second term? And at that time, though, it wasn't about illness, it was about age. And Ronald Reagan famously quipped during a presidential debate when the age issue was raised. Ronald Reagan said in the presidential debate that he would not exploit his opponent's youth and inexperience, thus neutralizing the whole question of his age and health. That's not going to happen in 2016, I don't think, you know, because, you know, frankly, Trump had already made it an issue, and now Hillary Clinton does have a health issue. She has been diagnosed with pneumonia. And so I don't think the issue is going away. I'm not entirely sure how it's going to play out, to be honest with you. Trump is saying now he'll release more detailed information. And because the candidates are older, as you point out, arguably the public has more of a right to know. I mentioned earlier that Barack Obama released nearly 300 pages about his health. He was only 47 in 2008 when he ran for president.
Right, pretty
yet
different.
Released, right. He was so much younger, yet felt compelled to release that much information. So whether they should or not, whether it's right or wrong, unfortunately, you know, that's the tradition. So I think they're both going to face a lot of pressure. Now, I'll say one other thing, which is there's another condition when a candidate's health and their age becomes especially important. And that's when the public doubts the qualifications of the vice presidential nominee. So in 2008, when John McCain nominated Sarah Palin to be his vice presidential nominee, not only was McCain much older, he was 71 at the time, but many people were questioning the fitness of Sarah Palin to serve as president. And so his, you know, that may have been a contributing factor to this release of thousands of, you know, hundreds, I should say, of pages. I don't think we have that issue now. No one is really questioning the fitness of Mike Pence on the Republican side or Tim Kaine on the Democratic side, but that would be a factor if the vice presidential nominee is not considered ready, you know, to lead should they have to.
We're talking right now with political scientist Melissa Miller about the issue of candidate health in this year's presidential race, how much it matters, is it going to influence people's votes, and how much access we should have to this information.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is the health of the presidential candidate something that you are thinking about, worrying about this election cycle? Will it influence who you vote for? And how much medical info do we have a right to know about our presidential candidates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about candidate health in the presidential race. In a recent interview, Donald Trump said health is definitely an issue after Hillary Clinton left a 9/11 memorial service due to illness, later diagnosed as pneumonia. Our guest is Melissa Miller, Associate Professor of Political Science at Bowling Green State University.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is the health of the candidates an issue for you? Does the fact that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are some of the oldest candidates to seek the highest office in the nation make you more concerned about their health and their ability to do the job of president? And is any of this actually going to influence who you vote for in November? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Charlie with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess, you know, I think this is rather important because we know that Ronald Reagan was suffering from Alzheimer's in the second part of his second term of presidency. And it is concerning because it probably did affect not only the decisions for his own White House, but for the whole nation. But on top of that, we have to think that if Donald Trump was bringing up Hillary Clinton's health, we got to remember that she told us lies about her emails, so she probably is also lying about her health. If you can lie about the emails and obstruction of justice, you can lie about your health, and there might be issues that would affect how people vote.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Let's start with Ronald Reagan there. I mean, that is a something people consider. He's one of the presidents people point to when you look at health concerns. It may have had an influence. Apparently, Alzheimer's takes these gradual changes over the course of decades. And did that affect the way he ran for office? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, secondly, Charlie getting it there, these issues of trust with Hillary Clinton.
Right. You know, we can look back historically and look at examples where voters didn't know. Potentially, the Reagan example is a good one. I don't know off the top of my head when that diagnosis was and whether it truly was hidden from voters in 1984. But I'll give you another example. If you go back to 1992, Massachusetts Governor Paul Tsongas ran for president, and his physicians gave the impression that he'd been cured of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he actually died from it 5 years later. So I think there just certainly are going to be individuals who, you know, maybe they decide to run and find out later. Or, you know, it's something that can affect. And certainly Charlie suggests this might affect his vote. So I think there are people who this information might affect their vote. Although, again, I would argue that, like, party loyalty and the party that you typically vote for is going to be the biggest driver of your vote. But Charlie also pointed out that he thinks that Clinton maybe shouldn't be trusted with what she's now saying about her health. And whether she should or shouldn't is, you know, I'm not going to weigh in on that. I'm not, you know, that's for people to decide. But going back to how we started the segment, unfortunately for Clinton, this feeds the narrative that she can't be trusted. And because of these issues of trust, because of the ongoing email scandal, the level to which people can trust her is just simply on the minds of voters. And, you know, political consultants usually tell candidates, be as transparent as possible. And so that's what I would suggest they do at this point, precisely to put voters like Charlie at ease about such things, or at least make them feel like they're making a choice with full information.
Charlie, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Margaret in Madison. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Say, I think history is full of examples of presidents having very serious illnesses. I mean, you clearly go back in time and think of Abraham Lincoln, suffered from depression. FDR went to great lengths to cover up his polio. JFK had Addison's disease. Eisenhower had heart trouble. I think it's very, very difficult to find out the truth about president's health because they will go to great lengths through their own physicians to cover it up. So I don't know if we're ever really going to have a clear picture on what any candidate's health is, because they're using their own physicians, and frankly, their advisors probably tell them to paint a picture of robust, good health.
Right. Good point, Margaret. I mean, everyone is going to want to appear as ruddy and healthy and robust as possible, so they're going to want to spin anything as something that's just a trifle, nothing to worry about, nothing to see here. So how are we ever really going to get the truth out of anybody?
I think Margaret makes an excellent point, and she pulled some examples I had in mind. Particularly, I was thinking about how Roosevelt had polio and was confined to a wheelchair, but many people didn't know it, certainly. So there are lots of good examples. And I actually like her insight about, like, the candidates then and now are definitely being advised to look healthy, to look, you know, that they're in their prime. And so, you know, irregardless of health, that's why you saw, I believe it was Ronald Reagan on his ranch riding on his horse and George W. Bush chopping wood. I think, the, you know, John F. Kennedy throwing a football. All of that where we see presidential candidates, like, you know, playing sports, it's about conveying health, vitality. There's an interesting little side then issue for a woman running for president. You know, I doubt we'd see Hillary Clinton or any other woman running for president throwing a football or throwing out the first pitch at a baseball game. So it does make it kind of a different question for women in terms of how they show that vigor and that vitality. But Margaret's right. There's not, in some ways, there's nothing new here, you know, in terms of candidates that do have health issues and their campaigns will try to make it appear that they're perfectly healthy.
We're talking with Melissa Miller right now from Bowling Green State University in Ohio, talking about the issues of candidates' health on both sides. And we're going to go right now to Sue in Door County. Sue, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good,
thank
you.
Thank you for taking my call. I just kind of tagged on what the guest was just saying. I think as I'm going to make up the gender card, we women will work through any illness, even when you're feeling terrible, you get yourself out of bed, you get your kids ready for school, you go to work, you do the carpool, you do anything you need when you're feeling terrible. I think most of us would agree that our men, when they don't feel well, will hang out on the couch and watch TV. So the fact that Hillary went to the 9/11 memorial service with pneumonia, she should be getting accolades that she did it. Not being condemned for going or keeping it a secret.
That's a point some people have made. Of course, a lot of people would disagree about men lying on the couch, I bet. Probably my husband is one of them. But Sue, to your point, that, look, she showed up. She was really sick.
Yeah.
She had pneumonia, and there she was. She's tough. So what about that narrative? Is that going to, do you think, convince people, too? Is there something to it?
Well, I would just tell Sue that, and she may have heard Tim Kaine, who gave a press conference this afternoon, Clinton's vice presidential nominee, in which he basically said, you know, we all know Hillary. We know her drive, basically. So, you know, sort of like, it really came as no surprise that she was going to kind of power through this. And one other interesting thing he said was that when he first ran for public office at the local level, he was diagnosed with pneumonia while campaigning. And had to make that decision whether to press on or not. So I thought that was just a fascinating parallel. But I think Sue's point might be important for the Clinton campaign to think about right now. So, you know, what's happened has happened, and they need to try to figure out how to put this issue to rest, put voters' minds at rest. And I think emphasizing that, you know, it's her commitment to campaigning, it's her commitment to the American people, it's her commitment to, you know, setting the country on the right track and so forth is why, you know, she didn't want to step off the trail immediately. So perhaps Sue needs to go into a career as a political advisor. However, I will also say, and as you point out, Veronica, it's still a little tricky because you don't want to suggest that only women, right, would, you know, that a man would have, you know, jumped right off the trail. You know, it is, it does get tricky when you get into that territory about, you know, how women are treated versus men or how women are act versus men. But I think Sue's insight is an important one.
Melissa, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
That was Melissa Miller, Associate Professor of Political Science at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. And she joined us there to talk about the issue of candidate health in this year's presidential race.